Before we get started with today's show, I want to remind you of another great ESPN podcast, Baseball Tonight with Buster Olney. He's been all over the latest from spring training, so be sure to check it out. You can download and subscribe to BBTN now, as well as download and subscribe to The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Let's talk about Daniel. A year ago, he resolved to stop putting off what he wanted to do, get into information technology. Daniel enrolled in My Computer Career and is already a few months into his IT career. Make 2020 your year. There are millions of unfilled cybersecurity positions in the U.S. right now, and My Computer Career is training people to help fill them. No IT experience or education? No problem. It's not rocket science. It's My Computer Career. Go to mycomputercareer.edu and take the free career evaluation today. You can start your new life as an IT pro in months, not years. Attend classes on campus or live online just twice a week to get what you'll need to start your new career. More than just a school, My Computer Career helps you get into the industry by working with hundreds of employers that hire our students. My Computer Career is nationally accredited and financial aid is available for those who qualify, including the GI Bill. Classes start soon, so make new year, new career your resolution and take the free career evaluation today at mycomputercareer.edu. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we will talk about Joe Burrow and his little bitty hands. We'll talk about Michael Jordan talking about Kobe Bryant. And we'll talk about you guys and the fight parties y'all went to. But first, all right, I guess first I kind of have to, Gabe's a little elephant in the room right now. I mean, the company put out a statement, so I ain't talking out of turn here. On March 27th, I think the day is, will be the last day that we do High Noon on television. It's always weird when that sort of happens because I'm not dead, but people are throwing flowers on top of me. And I appreciate flowers. Flowers smell good, right? It's kind of, it's thing. There ain't really so much I can tell you that I don't think is talking out of turn. A lot of this really comes down to a sort of this is the business that we've chosen sort of thing. But the part that I can tell you, and I mentioned this here in this space, because podcast is a bit more intimate, and some of you guys have been around with me and my work now for over a decade, sometimes even more. And I guess the bottom line that I could give you is I'm good, right? You don't want the TV show that you're doing to get canceled, but I personally am good. Like, nobody's running me out of here. I'm not being mistreated, I don't think, any of that stuff, right? So, like, me, myself, I am good. And if any of you have ever been around me when something like this happens in my career that doesn't necessarily go so well, like, that happens and then we keep on moving and then chances are something good's going to happen. So, like, if you are worried about me personally, I am good. If you are going to miss the television show, I will miss the television show too. And I know how you feel about that one, but this is how it goes. So, like, I can just play it easy off the top on that one and just say, yep, that news is true. Yes, that is going to happen. No, that is not like an optimal outcome for what I would want. But in the end, I am good. I'm all right. My man Pablo had a baby yesterday. The child is beautiful. No, she doesn't look like him. I mean, I let that was the unspoken part, but whatever. She's a really cute kid. You ought to check out a picture. You can put it up on the internet. She looks nice. Fantastic. All of that. We good. And even if we wasn't good, we better than Deontay Wilder. Damn. So I went ahead and put the money down on the fight. And by the way, I got to admit that, like, as I was putting the money down on the fight, I was like, shouldn't have somebody gave me the hookup on this? Like, it was on ESPN Plus. You saying I'm not plus, right? Like, damn, I can't get the hookup. But anyway, I went ahead, I hit the button. I paid for the fight. And so it starts off, your boy Tyson Fury comes out there because he the gypsy king. I didn't know he was the king of the gypsies. I just thought he was, you know, I knew he was a gypsy, right? I didn't know he was the king of them. But apparently he is the king of them. And he was in a chair, being carried to the ring like he was Strong J or something like that, right? And he comes out there, and the next thing I know, your boy Deontay Wilder come out there looking like a comic book character. I don't know if those were sequins or rhinestones or lights or whatever it was, but it was all black and it was dope. It looked incredible. I was like, yo, that's a double suit there. Except the only thing is, apparently the suit was very heavy, right? Apparently it was a very, very heavy suit, and I want you to think about the contrast here. Black man walking out there with the weight of the world on his shoulders. White man walking in there being carried. It could almost be a metaphor for life. And in fact, that is what apparently what Deontay Wilder is trying to say, is that it's a metaphor for life. Because you see this, Gabe, he said the reason that he ain't really bring it in the fight was because his legs were tired, because he had that heavy suit on.
Yeah, that is a miscalculation.
Yeah. That's not really going over so well in these streets. But I ask this as a serious question. Who remembers that time that a champion, an undefeated champion at that, but a champion in general, lost a fight, and then the next day, the people are like, what happened? And his response was, you saw what happened. I just got my ass kicked. Like, that's not how this goes. Deontay Wilder, he ain't lost a fight since, what, 2008 at the Olympics? He has been out here beating people's brains in over and over and over again. I imagine he never, ever considered the possibility that he could lose, and then he lost, and he seems to believe that all he needed to do was get it back together, and then he was going to win, because that's the only way that I can see why he's mad at that assistant trainer. Did you see, Gator, he fired the dude who threw in the towel?
Yeah, he is apparently in denial.
Well, he said that he would have rather died than have the towel thrown in. I'm going to ask this question seriously. Have you ever heard of somebody getting fired for saving his boss's life? Because that's what happened. This dude got fired because he saw his boss out there struggling and was like, yo, I can't let my boss go out like that. Let me save his life. And the boss was like, you're fired. I mean, look, I don't really know how these things work, like what the employment agreements are with the corner man and the champion. I don't really know how that goes. But, Gabe, you let me know. That sounds like a man that's got a lawsuit.
That's what he's paid to do.
Right. What'd you get fired for? I got fired for saving his life. These cats are different, though. Like, there's just no way around that. These boxing cats are wired a bit different. Wilder said he wants to get in on the other fight. And this is what I'm wondering, man. You trying to fire the dude that saved your life. Why are you not trying to fire the dudes that got you killed, or almost got you killed? Like, you need to start looking at that crew that got you prepared for the actual fight. He didn't appear to have much of a strategy, and they was going in the corner to talk to him, Gabe, and I didn't really feel like I was hearing no gems or no words of wisdom or no strategic adjustments.
Yeah, everything I've heard out of the fight is like, oh, Tyson Fury was much better prepared. How do you, like, pay trainers that aren't going to prepare you for a big fight, the biggest fight on the planet?
Yeah, but I also have to be fair to Wilder, though, on this one. And I think the suit made my legs weak excuse is problematic, right? Like, it's hard to buy into it. I will say, though, from watching the fight, don't forget that Wilder had a point where he went down and he didn't even get hit. The punches that were knocking him down weren't really like earth-shattering punches. If he had not had the blood coming from his ear, I'm not sure that we would have assumed that he was hurt as badly as we did assume that he was hurt. But the problem seemed to be throughout the fight that he didn't have any balance. I had attributed the lack of balance to the idea that his eardrum got busted, but his eardrum didn't get busted. He didn't have a broken jaw. It doesn't sound like he had a concussion, which then gets me to the question, why were your legs so wobbly then? And I really don't have a better answer than the suit. And I don't believe that the suit was the problem. I'm just saying I don't have a better answer than the suit. I don't have anything for it. And in the end, there's nothing that you're going to say after you get your ass kicked that people are trying to hear as the reason why you got your ass kicked. That's not going to cut it, homeboy. That's not going to be the thing. It ain't going to be it. And so there he was. He caught that L. They're going to do it again. I'll watch it if they do it again. And we'll talk more about this later, but, ooh, yeah. Gabe, it was very interesting to find out how many people in that crowd were gypsies. I didn't know the gypsy population was so strong. You think maybe they weren't all gypsies?
Yeah, I mean, I Googled this before the show, like, is Fury actually, like, of Romanian descent? Because that's, like, where the word gypsy comes from, and I didn't find any conclusive evidence.
Yeah, I mean, he claims it, right? He claims it tough. Apparently, he's from a long line of gypsies. I don't know that much about them outside of this one Law and Order episode that I saw one time. And I don't really feel like that gave me all the information that I was looking for in terms of, like, finding out, like, what the gypsies are about, how they living, so forth and so on. But Tyson Fury, America love him now. They absolutely love him now. He started singing American Pie after the fight, and I'm like, damn, y'all know all the words. Everybody do. Like, I love that song. It's the jam. It was a happy moment for Tyson Fury in winning that fight. And look, this is the thing that a lot of people in boxing have been wanting for a very long time, which is a white English-speaking champion. I said that on TV the other day. I had some people get mad at me about this. Y'all ain't never seen no movies. You ain't never seen The Great White Hype, or y'all ain't never seen Rocky. Y'all seen Rocky? Let me ask all y'all a question, right? If it was a black Rocky, you think Rocky's as popular as a movie as it is? I don't think it is. They tried to make a black Rocky. It was called Creed. People really like it. You know why? Because Rocky was in it. But it ain't Rocky. People don't feel the way about that like they do about Rocky. Y'all love Rocky. And it's in large part because it was the white dude fighting the black dude. Matter of fact, people love Rocky so much that Rocky didn't even win the first fight. And rather than point out the fact he didn't win the first fight, they ain't even like really play the announcement. I was like, why they talk about him not winning? He just out here trying to get up with his girl. I don't know about you, but I feel like that's a lack of priorities. I thought you was out here to win. You know what I'm saying? Like this is my understanding. So now you got Tyson Fury, and on top of it, Tyson Fury fits a broader archetype that all of us love, which is chubby athletes. We like very good chubby athletes. Gave the dude 6'9", 270, and it looked like the only thing he work out, like when it's time to box, the only way he work out by boxing.
Kind of like, you know, when you get those like really, really, really tall dudes where they almost just look a little out of shape.
Yes. You know what he looked like? He looked like a wrestler who would wear a suit with one strap or two.
Can't find a pair of pants that fit him, right?
Yeah. But you know, like most of the wrestlers, they out there in the briefs. You know what I'm saying? Right. The ones that come like, they just cover what you need more or less, right? And be a little bit broader. And then there's the wrestlers that got the long pants. And then there's the wrestlers that once they get into like this weight class, either they got the single strap that go across, like was that Betty Rubble, or they got to go with the two strap. Like King Kong Bundy, for example, he was a two strap guy. Andre the Giant, when he got to the strap portion, he was a one strap guy. You think Tyson Fury is a one strap guy or a two strap guy? I get the feeling he's a two strap guy, but maybe that's just because he's bald like King Kong Bundy. You remember King Kong Bundy?
No, I do not.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I guess that's a different generation of wrestlers there. You have at least heard of Andre the Giant.
Yes, I have.
Okay. Just checking. But no, they say that Fury is a great technical boxer. I don't even feel like that came up in the fight with Wilder. Like, what technique did he need in order to get that done? Like, Wilder just had nothing. For whatever the reason was, Wilder had zero to contribute to the fight. None whatsoever. And then he had to go back to the crib and try to explain to people how that big old fat white man beat him down. You know cats ain't trying to hear that. Like, it's one thing you got to explain to the world, then you got to go explain it to your partners. I imagine there's some dude back in his hometown who saw that and was like, you know what? I always thought I could take him. I'm going to try. Don't do that. No, don't. Those problems, you don't really want those problems. You don't. And I just want to say one last thing about that suit. Okay. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong here. Right. But this is what I want to say about that suit. Apparently Deontay Wilder wanted to wear that suit in honor of Black History Month. I don't really know what that had to do with Black History, because that looked more like the future than it looked like the past. But don't you blaming the ancestors right now. You know what I'm saying? Like if this is the way that you playing this and you saying that the suit made your legs weak, you blaming the ancestors right now. You saying that Hannibal, you know, my man from Carthage, you saying that carrying him into the ring is the reason why you lost. You going to say that Harriet Tubman is responsible for your defeat? Are you trying to blame Madam C.J. Walker for what has happened to you? Is that what you're doing? Ralph Bunche don't deserve this, man. Matthew Henson did not go to the North Pole for you to say that the problem was that you had him, his fly-ass coat, and his pinky ring on your shoulders. There's no reason for you to approach these things in this way. King Tut, this ain't about him. Cleopatra, oh yeah, she black too. She didn't do nothing to you at all. Don't blame this on the ancestors, man. This on you right now. Maybe you know what? Maybe he's talking about the black history that ain't even happened yet. Like the black history that was going to be on the moon. So maybe the Harriet Tubman. Oh, I hope we don't need another Harriet Tubman. Never mind. We find somebody better to use as my example. The Jackie Robinson of the future. There we go. You know, maybe the Jackie Robinson of the future will wind up wearing one of those suits. But this is not the fault of the ancestors. You just got your ass whooped. All right, we'll be back in a minute to talk about the celebration of Kobe Bryant's life. But first, what if a quarterback completed 4 out of 5 of his passes? Or a point guard hit 4 or 5 shots behind the arc? Well, now, when you're hiring, you can play at that level. Because 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. No matter the industry, healthcare to manufacturing to business services, ZipRecruiter makes hiring faster and easier. And today you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter doesn't wait for the right candidates to find you. ZipRecruiter's AI scouts talent for you. First, when you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent out to over 100 top job sites. Then ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right skills and experience, and invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates fast. And now, to try ZipRecruiter for free, my listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. That's ZipRecruiter.com/B-O-M-A-N-I. ZipRecruiter.com/Bomani. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right. So the Kobe Bryant celebration of life was on Monday. Gabe, was an eventful Monday at the office, in case you're curious.
Yeah, big day.
But you know what I realized about quickly in the Kobe Bryant memorial? I'm a great person to sit next to at a memorial service because I got jokes. Like, I understand it's a very solemn sort of situation, you know what I'm saying? And I get that people, you know, want to lock in on it. And I'm not really going to tell these jokes here because I know that y'all ain't really ready for them. Gabe, would you like to hear one of the jokes that the other people won't be able to hear?
I would like that.
All right, so.
Thank you for your patience. A representative from the right time will be with you shortly. Your current hold time is
15 seconds.
Oh, boy.
Like I said, I'm a good dude to sit next to at a memorial service. Because I got all the jokes. And apparently Michael Jordan also has the jokes. Mike gave a speech at the memorial service, which I thought was very good. I think that in a lot of ways, this was the most humanizing thing that we have ever seen from Michael Jordan. And so I wonder this about you, Gabe, because you are of an age where, like, Michael Jordan doesn't really belong to you in the way that he belongs to people around my age and a bit older. Like, does it resonate to you, just how cold Michael Jordan is? Like, just, like, why it is that people feel the way they do about Michael Jordan?
It does. What resonates with me and what I felt like is at least this figure that MJ has become is this kind of like not crotchety old man, but like emotionless old man. Grandpa at the like holiday party finally cracked.
Yeah.
Him cracking. You saw like they showed around the arena when Jordan was cracking up. Curry was cracking up. Vanessa Bryant was cracking up. Everybody was cracking up. It was one of those moments where everybody could join in.
Okay, but here's the thing about Mike. I don't view Mike as a crotchety old man because Mike was a crotchety young man. Like you saw the KG, J.R. Ryder story about Mike. Like this is Mike. Mike is the guy who destroys and all the Mike stories are hilarious. And see, the thing about Mike to me that is interesting is that at once Mike is way too far away from us, right? Like he seems he's basically like the sun, right? He seems close, but he's really, really far away. Like that's kind of the quality that Mike has. But all the great Mike stories are so amazingly like human, right? And part of the humanity of the Mike stories is the way that he makes everyone else quiver in his presence. Like the thing about that J.R. Ryder KG thing about KG talking noise to Mike and then Mike going out there and destroying him is J.R. Ryder being like, he young, Mike. He getting excited, Mike. J.R. Ryder, right? Like the immediate back down to Mike. Mike had everybody in the league shook. And it's not like he's Charles Oakley, right? It's not like he's some dude that's going to beat you up. He just had everybody shook that he was going to take their hearts. And that's what's so funny about Mike is all these stories. Nobody's got a story about the time they talked that smack to Mike and then they came out on top. People only have stories about talking smack to Mike and then winding up on a losing end. Like, that's the only thing that anybody ever has. And he is a hilarious idea just for that reason, right? Like, on one hand, we always say Mike is very polished and Mike made sure that he never said anything wrong. And he always made sure not to say anything wrong, right? He never was really going to get into too much trouble for the words that he had to say. However, it's not like he was some pristine figure. right? He was just really, 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 really cool. And so Mike gets up at this memorial, and he's the coolest dude in the room. And Mike's the coolest dude in the room because Michael Jordan is always the coolest dude in the room, right? He is that dude. And so Mike gives up to give the speech. And I thought that the way his speech went was very interesting because I like him talking about when I met Kobe, all I saw was this dude trying to be like me and how annoyed he was by the idea that this dude was trying to be like him. And that this dude is like trying to call him out at the All-Star game because he wants to bring it to Mike. And Mike is like, yo, who is this? And what I took from Mike's speech as it went along was, as Kobe leaned more into the idea of being Kobe Bryant rather than the idea of like being some other Michael Jordan, it became easier for Mike to accept because there wasn't this guy who was out here trying to replace you. And I imagine that for Kobe, leaning into being himself became a lot easier than trying to be a reasonable facsimile of Michael Jordan. And that then allowed Michael Jordan to, I don't want to say be humbled, but what Mike used to see in Kobe as something that annoyed him, he then, like, it really becomes that cliche about imitation being the highest form of flattery. Like, it seemed to really light Mike up that somebody as great at basketball as Kobe would try so hard to be like Michael Jordan. You know, like, you see that part where Mike said, Kobe hit him up and was like, yo, I want to, you know, teach my daughter some moves or whatever. And it was just like, you know, what kind of things were you, you know, when you were like, you know, what moves were you working on then? And Mike said, he asked Kobe, he's like, how old is she? And he goes, 12. And he was like, yo, when I was 12, I was playing baseball. You know, like Kobe had a focus on this stuff that Mike himself did not have. Like Mike's cut from something a little bit different than Kobe. But for Mike to be able to talk about the evolution and for him, how he wanted to be a big brother to Kobe as the time went on, that he wanted to be that guy that helped Kobe become a better man because Kobe was so dedicated himself to becoming a better man. I found that to be really, really, really interesting. I also, it made me think about something also, is that how much different is Mike than we think Mike is? Like, how much of this evolution that Kobe, that we witnessed Kobe going through, like, is it possible that Michael Jordan is doing this right now and we don't realize it, right? Because Mike ain't telling us nothing, you know? Like, maybe this is something that Mike is doing right now. Maybe this is the way that Mike is going about these things. Other than for the reason of laughing, I'd never given as much thought really to like what kind of man Michael Jordan was, because Mike didn't really want to give us no stories about what kind of man he is. He's kept those sorts of things away from us. Kobe, as the time went on, became more open. And I think a lot of that just kind of has to do with the generation that Kobe's a member of and the technology and everything else. But that was a very human Mike. And Mike crying and then talking about, I know I'm going to wind up being a meme. Fantastic. Absolutely, like, that was brilliant. By the way, Gabe, did you ever hear a few years ago somebody asked Mike about the Crying Jordan meme and what he thought of it? And Mike said, basically, as far as I know, nobody's making any money off of it, so we good.
You know what? I hadn't heard that one, but his response yesterday was, you know, I told my wife I wasn't going to do this and I'm going to be on the internet for the next 3 or 4 years.
Like, he nailed everything. Mike is so charming. Mike seemed to be up there in a suit with all them buttons, too, because he just keep on doing that. But everything about Mike, when it's time to get in front of the world, Mike managed to make it funny when he disrespected his children in his Hall of Fame speech. Right? Like, they only made one of these. And as tragic as it was, the idea that Michael Jordan is speaking at Kobe Bryant's funeral and or memorial service and not vice versa, as tragic as that is, I thought it was just really dope seeing a human Michael Jordan in a way that I don't think that we had really seen previously. But the memorial service, I thought it was well done. I was blown away by Vanessa Bryant's poise through all of that. Right? A, her willingness to share all of this with basically the world, and also just her ability to handle it. I can't imagine that I would be able to handle things in that situation in the ways that she did, right? Like, she, I think, like, it feels patronizing to be like, she deserves a round of applause or something like that. Like, I don't know what to say, but I just, I can only imagine the level of strength that it took in that moment to do, like, how about just simply getting on a microphone in front of 20,000 people? Like, I do cameras, I do studios. I get nervous in front of crowds. I get nervous in front of crowds far smaller than that one. I like it leaves me shook. And that's just talking about nothing, let alone talking about the things that she was there to discuss. You know, I absolutely wish her the best in everything. And I hope to be as strong as she demonstrated herself to be at any point in my life, let alone in a moment like that one. And we'll be back in a minute to talk about Joe Burrow, but first, sometimes for inspiration, you just have to look up. For more than 60 years, the Goodyear blimp has fueled greatness on the gridiron by providing aerial coverage of some of the most legendary moments in college football history. When the Goodyear blimp rises above a stadium, it inspires players to reach higher and rise to the challenge of the game's biggest moments. Now, it's your turn to go further with Goodyear. Discover tires made to rise above the rest. Learn more at Goodyear.com. Goodyear, more driven. All right, Gabe, combine going on, NFL combine. Something tells me you're not a person that cares nothing about that.
You would assume correctly.
Neither do I, by the way. The combine, the way I've always described a combine is like the SAT, basically. It's standardized testing, you know? A lot of that stuff, the 40-yard dash, I think, is the one I've always called specifically the SAT. But that's just kind of what it is. I think the combine has a value, right? It's just kind of the economies of scale of everybody being able to do all this stuff at one time. I think that the, I'm not one of these people that, like, tries to outsmart the combine per se, which I think a lot of people do. I think it's very easy for more educated folks to look at what they consider to be the cavemen who, like, make football in the NFL run. And to just be like, oh, you do all this stupid stuff. Now, I kind of generally believe that most of that stuff is probably there for a reason. But now we're in the world of hand size, Gabe, and Joe Burrow measured in at 9 inches on the hand size, which is one of these smaller hand sizes that anybody has turned up. And now it's time for us to talk about hand size.
How big are your hands?
I have no idea, but I'll tell you this. Every professional athlete's hand I shake got a bigger hand than I do.
Really? Really?
Yeah, those dudes' hands are giant. Giant. Like, and I'm well known for having long fingers and big hands. Dude, these athletes, it's a completely different ball game when we start talking about, like, the size of their hands. Like, Joe Burrow's hand at that 9 inches might honestly be bigger than mine.
Really? Because, I mean, there's a difference also, too, between, like, power forward on a hoops team or, like, a defensive end or, like, a linebacker coming through might have bigger hands than a QB.
Yeah, well, I think, okay, so here's my thing. I don't think we need to look at a hand size measurement as a direct indicator of success, right? Like, I've seen people say this, there's no correlation between hand size and success. But I would be curious to see how hand size interacts with other variables, right? So if you're talking about hand size plus, you know, I don't know, like add some other characteristic to who that quarterback is. Now, what are we talking about, right? Like, now, like, does this, because I think the thing about hand size that seems obvious is that one would think that A, there would be a relationship between hand size and fumbles. And B, the question would be about your ability to grip a football in bad weather if your hands are small. That all seems to be a reasonable thing to ask. Those also seem to be things that operate on the margins. So it wouldn't be enough with Joe Burrow to make people like, yo, 9-inch hands, can't take them. But if there was somebody who was also in Burrow's class, like that you thought was similarly good, then I do think that would be a question that you wound up asking. There are dudes out here, man, where hand, like in basketball, I think that was one of the things with Kwame Brown, for example. He had bad hands and he had small hands. And this is basketball, I know, but like one of the underrated things about basketball, I don't think people talk about is just the distinct advantage of having giant, strong hands. Kawhi Leonard is a great example of a guy with giant, strong hands. Connie Hawkins, Dr. J, Michael Jordan. Like, these are examples of guys where you watch them play and having those giant, strong hands obviously had a positive effect on their careers. John Stockton is a great example of a guy, like what you can do when you have giant, strong hands. So like in that sport, it matters. I can totally see circumstances under which in football that can come up. It's not going to be like you're the only determinant, but there's something to it. But the reason I wanted to talk about hand size is I want everybody to remember the first time that any of us really gave a damn that I remember at the combine about hand size. And you know when that was? That was the year 2014. One guy had the big hands. One guy had the small hands. The small hands was Teddy Bridgewater. Guy with the big hands was Johnny Manziel. Now, this is why I bring this up. I remember that 2013 season. That was my first one in Miami. And I told Dan the whole way, because the number one quarterback, the guy that people thought was the number one quarterback going into that draft that whole season was Teddy Bridgewater, right? That was the guy. He had that great Sugar Bowl performance as a sophomore, and this was the guy as his junior year that we were looking at as like, this is the guy going in. And what the thing that was interesting about Teddy was you couldn't say the black quarterback stuff about Teddy, right? Because Teddy had played that pro-style offense. Teddy made all the reads. Teddy did all that stuff, right? He was a standard pocket passer. And so you couldn't say all that stuff to dismiss him. But you had Blake Bortles, who's at Central Florida, like running that spread. And then you had Johnny Manziel, who was running the spread at Texas A&M and who was hell on wheels off the field, right? And I told Dan that whole season, I was like, just wait till you see the ways they find to pick Teddy Bridgewater apart. And they did. And when it really started was with hand size. And what you wound up with going into that draft was people who were explaining that Teddy's hand size mattered. And that Johnny Manziel's hand size mattered, right? And the explanation on Manziel was that since he had those big hands, that mattered more than height did, right? As a way to elevate Johnny Manziel in the rhetoric that surrounded that draft. In that same draft was Jimmy Garoppolo. Jimmy Garoppolo's hands measured, as I recall, right around what Teddy Bridgewater's hands measured. It may have been the same. Gilbrandt was talking about Garoppolo's hands and said he'll be fine. He was talking about Bridgewater's hands, and it was an explanation as to why somebody wouldn't take him that high. Now, this year, the hands guy is Joe Burrow, and what you're going to see as a result is a lot of people dismissing the idea that hand size matters because look at Joe Burrow, right? That's what's going to happen. That's what it's going to be. Look at Joe Burrow. And I'm not saying that hand size is or is not that important. Again, I think it's an interesting variable, interesting piece of data to look at, but I don't know how much it like really sways things in a big way. What I'm telling you though is when you see these discussions of stuff like hand size around the draft, they're used to serve agenda typically. Right? These things only matter when people want them to matter. And yeah, is 9 1/4 for Jimmy, Gabe?
Yeah, 9 1/4 for Jimmy.
Yep, 9 1/4 for Teddy.
9 1/4 for Teddy.
Yep, and like Gilbrandt had this, 9 1/4 inch hands, smaller than I thought, many thought, played with two gloves at Louisville, right? So like we got him, he's there talking about the hands. And with Garoppolo, he's like 9 1/4, should be fine. With the same number. Right? With the same exact number. And I'm not saying that to like throw any particular shade at Gilbrandt. I'm just telling you the way that this data winds up being used. And so my man David Fleming, a great writer at ESPN, well, not the magazine anymore, writes for ESPN. And he wrote a thing about the myth of hand size and how this came up and how it's been, you know, used as a weapon, in this way. But in the end, we as people who cover this, we barely know what we're doing with it, and so we just use it in the ways that people decide that they want to use it. By the way, Teddy Bridgewater, his team was 5-0 when he was a starting quarterback last year. Johnny Manziel, begging to play in the XFL. Which leads me to say, no, hand size, not the be-all, end-all.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bo, this first story comes from travel.
My name is Natalie Compton, and I'm the tips reporter for By the Way, a new travel destination for the Washington Post. And one of the most common questions I get from readers and friends is about booking flights. And I think that's because it is one of the most confusing, misunderstood practices that we have in travel. One of the stats that really shocks me is that an airfare can change up to 130 times before your departure. So question is, when do you buy a flight? How do you do that? Are you going to make the right decision for getting something that is the best value for you? So one of the things that we looked at was the ways that you could lock down an airfare without necessarily committing. And that's not due to travel insurance or something, but there are a few different things that you can do to look at a flight, buy it, and then maybe get rid of it later. So one of those first things is to buy your ticket and then cancel it. This is possible because the United States has a law that says that airlines have to let you cancel a ticket within 24 hours. The catch is that you have to do this if you booked directly through the airline, and you cannot have the ticket within 7 days of your flight. So it has to be something ahead of time, and you have to cancel it within a 24-hour window. Now, a lot of airlines might have different little tweaks on this rule, so you want to make sure ahead of time exactly what you're doing. Another thing is that some airlines will let you pay some money to lock the fare, and that is something that American Airlines does, Hawaiian Airlines does, so check with an airline to see if you can do that too. And lastly, if you use the app Hopper, you have the option of paying a little deposit to freeze your flight for up to 7 days. So if you wanted to check with your friends on whether or not they still want to do the trip or wait to get paid, whatever different reasons that you wanted to hold off until you bought it, you can use the app Hopper to do that.
I gotta say, I hope it don't. Buy the flight or not, you can't just squat on a seat. Cool if you get to squat, but when you going on and keep seeing all these flights that ain't got no availability, but they really got availability because these people know damn well they ain't really got the money. Oh, did my privilege come out? Did it just fly out of there? I ain't called nobody brokies. I'm not doing that per se. I just feel like it's like you saving the seat by putting your jacket in it and then just walking away and not coming back for like, I don't even have a great analogy for this. I just feel like they squatting. Okay, but it says here, customers can freeze a price for 7 days to give them more time to make a decision. But this doesn't, so they don't necessarily get the seat. They just freeze in the price.
From what Natalie is describing, there's like a 24-hour window for the cancellation thing. Then there's the 7-day window with Hopper. So it's not like you can squat on a seat for like weeks on end.
Okay, got it.
It's so, not like, oh, you know, I'm flying back home to the West Coast to see my family. I'm going to lock in that $300 round trip like 6 months in advance. And then 1 month before the flight leaves, it's like, oh, no, I'm back. I'm back. Thanks for saving my seat.
Yeah, I would like the 24-hour thing. That makes sense. Okay, I'm feeling better about this. They're not squatting on the seats. They're squatting on the price. As long as I can still buy the seat if you haven't paid for it. That's all I'm saying. You know what I'm saying? Snooze and lose, homie. I just should be able to buy it if you ain't bought it. That's all I want.
Good info from Natalie there.
Yes, sorry for misrepresenting it.
Our next one comes from Tech.
Catherine Trendacosta, lead policy analyst for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, writing for Slate's Future Tense. So basically, the situation is this. In Hollywood, big tech, and in internet service providers, ISPs, there are a few huge players whose concerns aren't making the best TV, streaming service, or giving us the best internet access and speeds. Their concerns are growing very big and making it as difficult as possible for us to make meaningful choices. And in the new streaming wars, where your internet provider, your streaming service, and the studio making the shows that are on the streaming service all belong to a single mega corporation with little oversight and a lot of money, this dynamic is especially clear. A large number of Americans don't even have a choice in internet provider, which means that without net neutrality, ISPs have a monopoly on your eyeballs. They can give you their own content for free or at a discount and degrade the quality of a competing streaming service, locking you into using what they own. And you won't get to go, oh, but I watch NBC more than I watch HBO. I prefer Comcast to AT&T. That choice basically doesn't exist. These companies can use copyright like a club against outside creativity, the lack of net neutrality rules to force users into certain services, and their monopoly power to prevent anyone from having a meaningful choice in their media. We're going to see a lot of streaming services launch this year, and unless we act, it's all going to get very bad for regular people. Luckily, we do know what works here. We had strong net neutrality protections, and we can again. We know that free, easy, and cheap services beat piracy far better than draconian copyright penalties. And we know that companies shouldn't get to be this big and have this much power. This is a situation where we may not have money on our side, but we definitely have the numbers to demand better.
You realize that we're going to be like yearning for the good old days of cable? Like, you realize that's going to happen? And we just gonna be like, man, don't you remember how easy life was when we had cable? All you had to do was pick up a remote control, hit some buttons, and boom, you had TV.
You don't think that a number of these streaming services that are launched, like Catherine's describing, that are connected to the different service providers, that they're going to crash? Crash, like, come out with a bang and be like, all right, you know, we're throwing a lot of money into this because we want to get in on the streaming wars, and then it just doesn't turn out well, and then they get bought by bigger ones?
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like people just start companies now so they can get bought. You know, since everything just kind of gets sucked up in this vacuum where the whole point is to build it, to sell it. Like, that's the only reason that people are getting in there. I agree with you, though. Like, this is only but so sustainable. What's wild to me about the streaming stuff, I think we talked about this before, is I guess it's because of, like, the way that you pay for it and the numbers aren't that big individually and you just got to spread it around or whatever. But I feel like people get all the streaming services just in case something comes up this one time that everybody else is watching.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, a lot of money is burned just because, like, I got a bunch of them, but I got money to blow, right? Like, that's an important thing for me to point out. Like, yeah, I got a bunch of them that I don't watch, but it's not really, like, affecting me in that way. But everybody, all your friends on the internet talking about this thing that's on Hulu, and you don't have Hulu, you might wind up going and getting Hulu, then you forget to cut that thing off, right? Now, all of a sudden, you got Hulu. Now, you got all these things. Like, as much as the argument, and this is where, like, a kind of basic economics argument comes up. I don't even know if it's basic's the right way to put it, but you'll get me. So, like, you remember when the hybrid cars, like, first came out, right?
Yes,
and the argument was, and it's obviously a good argument, like, you should get, if you're going to get the hybrid, get it because it's better for the environment, but don't get it because it's going to save you money on gas. And I say that because, yes, you will save money on gas, you will spend less money on gas, but the person that's selling you that car is like, well, this person now has all that gas money to spend. How'd you like to spend it on a car? Right? They're going to build that into the price because in the end, when you and your mind are doing the long-term, like, cost function on this, as long as it comes out better, you're going to be good, right? And so they still charge you more money for the car so that you can then ultimately save money on the gas. And that's very similar to what happens in these situations, right? Is that you feel like you're cutting the cord and you're going to save money because this is so much cheaper than cable. And those people are like, whoa, you got that money you were giving to cable. Now let's find ways for you to give it to us. Like, it's always going to wind up leveling out. You're not going to save money doing something like this for long. And they're going to raise these prices on these services. And then you're going to be like, damn, how come cable is not as good as what cable was?
Yeah, I mean, two things there. So the hybrid value proposition thing, it's different now, I guess I would say, maybe than like the initial kind of like early adopter phase of the hybrids, because of the tax credits that you can get and rebates and stuff that try to balance out the like initial sticker price of the car.
Yes.
Right. So like, I just wrote a paper about CAFE standards, which are like emissions standards set by the federal government. And there's a lot of talk about like freezing the emissions standards or like trying to roll them back so that they're lower, because they're like, oh, well, if you can lower the sticker price of the car, that's great for people because cars are too expensive now because they're trying to spend too much money to try and make the cars more efficient. But ultimately, at the end of the day, like, what the analysis has been is that, yeah, you'll save money on the overall sticker price of the vehicle because it'll be cheaper. But in the long run, the gas is going to cost more because the car isn't going to be as efficient. So, like, it's a little bit easier to buy, like, a hybrid or buy an electric car now because of all the rebates. But with the streaming stuff, it's like, you have to be really, really good and have a lot of content that people want in order to have like a successful streaming brand. So to your point about like a lot of the apps, like, or a lot of the companies wanting to start it up just so that they can get bought, it's like they're going in it with the feeling that they're not going to be committed to it and they're not going to like take the time and effort that it's going to take to build out like a really successful high-end streaming service.
Right.
And they don't want to make that value proposition. It's much cheaper and makes much more sense to just put your stuff on other people's platforms. Eventually Netflix is going to win out in this.
Look at us putting everybody up on game. That's what we do, baby. That's what we do.
All right, this next one also comes from tech.
Hey, so this is Zach Duffman, and I wrote a piece for Forbes this week on Airbnb pushing new surveillance bugs out to hosts who want to make sure their guests are not misbehaving. These bugs, they're called party prevention devices, and there are three available, ranging from $150 to $200, some of them also including a monthly fee. They're all currently on offer, so if surveillance is your thing, you can pick one up right now for as little as $40. Plan is, you buy this device, you fix it to the wall or the ceiling in your property, and it stops wild partying taking place. If something does happen, you get alert to your mobile phone. None of the devices record what people actually say. None of them capture video. They are noise detection devices. And the CEO of one of the companies that makes those devices told me that respect for privacy runs through everything they do. For Airbnb, they're obviously on a mission to tidy up after the stories of wild house parties and homes getting wrecked have hit the headlines over the last few months. Back in December, Airbnb announced a plan to help the community stay safe, including new mechanisms to support hosts, guests and neighbours who have concerns about unauthorised parties or disturbances. And so we now have these devices. On its website, Airbnb says it does not endorse any of them. But as someone suggested to me on Twitter, they don't endorse them, but they're pushing them on their website, and they're not sure if that really works out. The response to the story on social media has been pretty evenly split. Many have argued it's the right of homeowners to protect their properties, but others have warned it stinks a bit of Big Brother and mass surveillance and everyone being watched. And what if you turn up the TV too loud or you have noisy kids? Do the cops turn up? From Airbnb's perspective, there are strict rules on the use of the bugs. No bedrooms, no bathrooms. Guests need to be told they're there, and there are even warnings in listings, I believe. Behind this story, there have been issues with Airbnb hosts installing much more malicious surveillance in their homes that does include video and audio, none of which guests know about. And maybe ultimately that's the issue here. If we normalise surveillance in this way, but then try to draw a line under what's good surveillance and what's bad surveillance, it becomes much harder to stop people going too far. So, bottom line, is this a privacy nightmare or a step in the right direction? I guess it's up to people to decide.
You know what Airbnb is? A bad idea.
A bad idea?
That's all it is. And it's an idea that can make money. But when you really look at all the things that come up with Airbnb stuff, you just stop and realize, you know what? Maybe people's houses aren't meant to be treated like hotels. So I put it like this. So like using Airbnb to do like a long-term rental of your house kind of makes some sense. Like we're going to be gone for a month or something like that. Somebody needs one, like a kind of exchange there. Okay, cool. But this idea that people are just going to come in and stay 2-3 days at a time or whatever and treat it like a hotel, because these people have been conditioned by hotels. Right? You can do all this wild stuff at hotels. Hotels know you're going to come in here and do all this wild stuff. You are not a hotel, right? So like I always say this about people, like never underestimate the value of a professional. Everybody, like anybody can move their own stuff out of their own house. But when the movers come in there and you listen to that symphony of tape and they get all that stuff done so fast, you realize, hey man, just because I can do it doesn't mean I should do it. A house, like a hotel is a professional. A house is an amateur. I don't know if you should put your amateur in the way of this professional activity.
Yeah, and then you feel bad for the Airbnb owners when people were trashing their place. But to your point, it's like, it is a hotel. It's difficult to kind of convince people that it's not.
Yes.
And how to treat it. I mean, I was like an early adopter to the Airbnb experience. I like being able to stay in a neighborhood that I enjoyed where it wasn't one of those neighborhoods where there would be hotels.
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of puts you in a position to be able to operate on a travel schedule where you're not renting a car and you can kind of walk around, get a feel for what it's like to actually live there. But now, I mean, I would say it's funny. I just like booked a future vacation for myself with a couple of Airbnb spots. And now with all of the different little service fees and cleaning fees and all that sort of stuff, it's like, you know, $100 on top of the actual like list price.
Yeah. And look, man, it's bad. Also, since the competition is hotels, the prices are always going inch up, right? But the other thing is, it's bad for the people that are renting. Like, you're dealing with this surveillance type stuff or whatever. People got these horrible stories of the owner showing up and acting wild, ridiculous, and all of this. Like, Airbnb requires a level of trust from all parties involved that, and this sounds crazy, it's hard to maintain without a certain level of corporate oversight. Right? Because what the corporation has is the brand, and they have to care about what the brand is. These Airbnb folks, like, they concerned about getting bad reviews, but people are playing the game on the reviews where what they do is they get out ahead of your bad review and put a bad review of you up first, and then nobody can tell who's telling the truth.
Yeah, and I mean, like, kind of a way to disseminate fact from fiction on Airbnb is to go with what they call, like, a super host. And supposedly that's someone that you can like really trust, right? Or, yeah. And, but that's you trusting the corporation to trust that person.
And they have no customer service worth discussing.
Yeah. As we've discussed in this segment before, which is a little alarming, but to the surveillance thing in your hotel room, you're not rest assured that you're not going to be surveilled because of legal protections there.
Mm-hmm.
But once you put cameras into these homes, if you have this situation happen to you and you're going to file a lawsuit, you still got to file the lawsuit. You still have to hire the lawyer. So at the end of the day, it's just money out of your pocket.
Now you're right. Yikes. All right, we'll be back in a minute to do a segment with your calls. But first, we'll be back in a minute to talk about Friday night at the Staples Center. But first, tired of that 2:30 feeling? You're not alone. In fact, research shows that more than 70% of us hit the wall after lunch. Let a 5-hour energy shot help you leap over that wall instead of crashing into it. Anyone who travels frequently knows how tiring it can be. Whether you're on business or on vacation, 5-hour energy shot can help you stay alert and energized wherever you may be headed. 5-hour energy helps you get through your crazy on-the-go life. With zero sugar, 4 calories, and a convenient portable size, it's the perfect pick-me-up for busy, hard-working people. Now it comes in 2 extra-strength tropical tastes. Strawberry banana and tropical burst. They're great. They are delicious and can take you to a tropical on-the-go experience. Try them both, then go online to shop5hourenergy.com and use the code BOMANI to receive a one-time offer of 10% off your order. That's shop5hourenergy.com. Use the code BOMANI. Go to shop5hourenergy.com and use the code BOMANI to receive a one-time offer of 10%. 5-Hour Energy. Energy on the go. Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bo. So how was your fight party?
It was a fight party of one. I was going to go watch the fight with my brother because his wife was out of town. And then I told him it was going to start at 12. And he was like, nah, I don't see that happening, dog. So I took a nap beforehand and then watched it.
There you go. There you go. Well, for the voicemail segment for today, we asked people what their fight parties were like, and we got one from this year, and we got a couple of some historical fights, which were kind of interesting. Our first comes from KP in Fort Lauderdale.
So we went to my buddy Sean's house for the fight, and we're all going to watch it, about 7 or 8 of us. Nice mixture, black, white, a few Spanish people, so it was nothing big. So the fight happened, and we're talking all kind of mess. We're going to have, you know, having a great time. And I just kind of noticed that Sean, whose house it is, he happens to be one of the white guys. He just slowly starts moving away from the TV where everybody was hanging out. Towel goes throwing, all of us are losing our minds. We're like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. This is crazy. And I turn around and I look and I notice Sean walking back in with the biggest Irish flag I've ever seen in my life. I've known this dude for 20 years and I'm almost positive that he is a country white dude and never once opened his mouth to say that he was Irish about anything. And when I saw him, I was like, what the hell is this? He then proceeded to put on a fake Irish accent and talk like he was an Irishman for the rest of the night, which pissed all of us off. I'm serious. Needless to say, we got up out of there probably about an hour later because down here there was like some big festival going on and it was entirely too many minutes for us to wait for Ubers. That was the longest hour and a half I had to wait. I almost considered walking home because I didn't want to hear this dude talk like a damn Lucky Charms man. All right, peace.
Wow. So I asked after the fight, I asked people, so like, how did your, who watched the fight in mixed company, how'd that go? And I had people accusing me of making it about race. Are you kidding me? Every single one of y'all got a story like this. All y'all.
Isn't it so kind of American, too, to just all of a sudden try and claim something like European as if, like,
yo,
that's you. That's your squad.
This is my thing on this, okay? If you want to root for the white dude, I understand it. Just don't never say no USA, USA when you're rooting against the American. Like, that's the only thing about it that gets me. It's like, hey, man, I know how these things kind of go. I'm not really tripping, but You be jumping on white dudes from countries that we don't even necessarily rock with like that. You just, like, whatever white dude it'll take, that's the one that you jumping on. And just acknowledge then that as much as you might claim to love America, your allegiance is actually to white.
People want to pick and choose, man.
Yeah, but I say, like, when those two things come in conflict, if you keep on picking white, just ask yourself what that means. That's all I'm saying. And no, because here's the other thing, too. Black folks are doing the same thing because you just can't really be out here rooting for no white dude to beat no black dude up, right? Like, I mean, you can understand why it's a little different for us. I think that you can get it. Like, this ain't the thing. But we don't really get our hearts all caught up in this way, man. People tell stories about going to these, like, watching these things in bars. I talked to a woman at the office, and she just talked about the black woman, how uncomfortable it was in this bar watching the fight. And she said the irony was the white dudes were singing every word of the national anthem before they rooted for Tyson Fury. How that work?
No God Save the Queen?
That's what I'm saying. How that work?
Oh, my God. All right, this next one comes from Greg in Chicago. He had a story about Floyd and Ricky Hatton.
Oh, yeah. It's similar theme.
Back in, like, 2006 or 2007, I forget which year it was, I was living in Fort Lauderdale, and my girlfriend at the time worked at a design company, and a bunch of the ladies there, their boyfriends were British and Australian and South African because they worked on some of the yachts down in South Florida. So Mayweather was fighting Ricky Hatton at the time, and I didn't want to buy the fight because I didn't really have any friends that lived in Fort Lauderdale that would come up to watch the fight. So they all said they were going to this British pub to watch the fight. So I thought about it, and I said, man, I don't really want to pay $50 for this fight and watch it alone. I'll go watch it with my guys. So we go to the pub, and it's all rowdy Brits the whole night, going crazy. We walk in the door, they're doing the whole, it's only one Ricky Hatton, the whole chant and everything, going absolutely nuts. I'm the only black person there. It's as if there's no black people from the UK that exist or something like that. Anyway, I'm in the bar, and I'm on my best behavior the whole night. I'm quiet. I'm listening to all this ridiculous rhetoric about how Hatton is too fast and too strong, and whether it's a fraud. I'm listening to all this the whole night, and I'm just keeping my cool because I realize that if it goes down, I am in enemy territory and there's nothing that could save me. If you remember that fight, though, Mayweather hit Hatton with that check left hook, knocked him into the turnbuckle, and then knocked him out. When he hit him with the left and had hit the turnbuckle, instinctually, I just screamed, yeah, that's what you get, you MF-er. And the bar was just quiet. Silent. I looked around and everybody was looking at me. And my homie Mark looked at me and said, yo, Greg, I'm gonna pay your tab, but you need to get the F out of here right now. So I ran out the door, hopped in the car, drove home. Last time I watched the fight in Mid Company.
Yo! Like, being that happy about Floyd doing something good ain't the greatest look, I have to say, but you should have known better.
Also, too, like, the excuse that, like, oh, he's the better fighter, he's more, like, technically savvy. You hear the same thing with Fury.
Yeah, but, and look, he might have been, right? Because he is a technically savvy fighter. Like, I don't want to pretend as though that is not the case about some of these dudes. But I've had some people tell me that it was the Mayweather-Hatton thing that made them realize just what boxing does to people. It was that fight where they were like, oh, okay. Because the other thing was Mayweather dominated him. And people really tried to pretend like it was closer than it was.
Well, this last one was from a Canelo and Floyd fight from way back in the day.
All right, Bowman. So your boy decided he was going to throw a party for Canelo and Floyd. I'm like, yeah, you know, I'm working with a couple guys, Hispanic guys. I'm like, hey, man, we can throw the party at my crib. Everything will be cool. My man's hit me, yeah, but I'm going to bring my people with me. I was like, all right, my people going to be there, too. I didn't realize what he meant by his people. So, like, the party jump off, and, like, they show up, sombreroed out, like, hats and everything. Like, yeah, this is going to be the day. My boys pull up in the flowing hats and the T-shirts, and I'm like, oh, this different. So, man, the fight get going, and, you know, Floyd doing his thing. He moving. He ain't really getting hit. You can tell Canelo, and you can tell my Hispanic friends, they're getting kind of nervous. Then Modelo started disappearing off the counter quick. Like, uh-oh, liquor, Canelo losing, this is going to get ugly. So, man, we got to the end of that fight, and dude yelled, ah, man, Canelo's going to win this fight, or we riot. Man, I'm looking around my house like, man, they're going to break everything in here. Man, when they announced Floyd was the winner, the homies stood up, dapping each other up, yelling, money team. That's when them dudes in the sombreros realized they were outnumbered. Man, they tucked and took every Modelo they could find and got out their building so quick. Appreciate the time, bro.
Woo, yo, I got to say, you rolled the dice on it, because I keep talking about this in the context of black people and white people. I really ain't trying to do the mixed company with our Mexican brothers. And the reason is, like, our Mexican brothers, from what I can tell, they care more about boxing than we do, right? Like, we just kind of, like, I feel like for a lot of, like, black folks in boxing, you just got to drop in when there's a fight. But I feel like our Mexican partners, like, boxing in Mexico means something different than boxing means in the United States. So they way too invested in this to begin with. You just here for a good time. This means something else over there. Oh, no. I'm like, he said his partners realized that the cats realized they was outnumbered. I'm glad they can count, or at least that they can count, and then they take counting to mean something, because not everybody is like giving up just because they outnumbered. Anybody lose? You did
it? You didn't.
Okay, just checking. I tell you about the time my homeboy went and watched. It wasn't the Mayweather-Canelo fight that he saw. It was Mayweather, may have been De La Hoya. But he went to Vegas, and he said he was watching like one of them closed circuit joints, and something happened, and some black dudes got into it with some Mexicans, and the Mexicans started stopping the black dude out. And I asked my boy, what'd you do? He was like, I got out the way. I didn't want them to think I was with him.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Nah. The interracial fight party, it can go a whole bunch of different directions, guys. It can go a bunch of different directions. I had a partner tell me that he said something about, he tweeted that, everybody should root for Wilder in the fight. He got uninvited from the fight party he had been invited to because they didn't want no social justice warrior there. And he's like, no, man, he's from Alabama. I'm from Alabama. That's why I'm rooting for Wilder. Nope, they weren't trying to hear it. Got uninvited. Yeah. Fun times, man. But hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Also, thank you to our sponsors. Thanks to My Computer Career. Thanks to ZipRecruiter. Thanks to 5-Hour Energy. Also, thank you to Goodyear. Also, thank you to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thank you to Natalie Compton of The Washington Post. Check out her story about how you can book a flight without booking a flight. You'll understand what I mean. Also, thank you to Zach Doffman of Forbes. Check out his story on Airbnb recommending surveillance devices to keep the guests in line. And also thanks to Catherine Trendacosta. She is a policy analyst at Electric Frontier Foundation. Check out her story about what's the next level of the streaming wars. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater, and we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.